It's all very exciting, isn't it? Okay, we will have Brendan Devaney joining us in the not-too-distant future, so stay tuned for that. Going to look back on the weekend's GE action with an eye, of course, on the DL Debate podcast. We're just waiting for consultant Mr. Michael Sugrue to join us. He's just not joining at the moment, so I'm just holding off to try and keep those plates spinning, so stay where you are. Greg, never had the frailty help at the front door when my elderly parent over 90 years had to sit in the ED for 20 hours. It doesn't exist, and I'm a retired member of staff. It did tweak my interest, that statement. We have just come out of hospital, me and my elderly mother. There was no front door care. Again, that has been my experience. Pity we didn't have a politician in Donegal like Mary T. Everything she said is spot on. Can't believe they're going to stop consultants speaking out. Indeed, and that came from a former consultant. He warned us of that. There's elections coming up, so Mary T. Sweeney will be standing in those if that's your thing. Greg, good to hear Betty on, and she still hasn't lost her passion for our hospital. Brings back the memories of when we brought an estimated 15,000 people onto the streets, and RTE reported it as 6,000. Probably needs to happen again. P.S. Thousands are used for private transportation and sending patients from the ED and home on discharge when they have no home in the early hours, etc. Okay. We will go to Michael Sugrue. He might have been... We'll come back to him a little later on because, as I say, they're all incredibly busy, aren't they? So he'll come with us. Come on with us in a second. Right, we have Brendan Devaney now. Looking forward to the DL debate, reflecting on the weekend's action. Good morning, Brent. How are you getting on?
Not too bad, Greg. A bit of a head cold, but I don't think you can catch it across soon.
No, I'm hopeful. I can't. Right, now, I suppose we'll start with the most recent match yesterday. 30 years since a win of this magnitude for Downings. A big result. Yeah. Disappointment for Mallon, but big result for Downings.
Yeah, do you know what, Greg? Funny when you get to this time, maybe I'm getting a bit mellow as the years go on. But yeah, you really feel for the losers in this because it would have meant so much over the weekend to either side. The one, obviously, Mallon, who were a senior team for many a year, looking to get back to where they believe they belong. And it's 22 years since, as well, they were in a intermediate decider, but it was 30 years for Downings, and they made it count. They're a remarkable story, Greg, when you think that they just won the junior title in 2021. So, brilliant rise to fame for them. Both of them are operating in Division 1 this year, and are two clubs on the up and up. Mallon last season, you know, had a very poor championship. They didn't win a game, so they really come into this one, I think, with a bit between the teeth. I know Michael Byrne down there, really nice lad, and created a real club focus, and listen, they were right there. Not much in it, Greg. It comes down to the wire in these games. 11-9, but Downing's a better side in the day, and I'd have to say Kevin Coogie Geller, of course, what a top guy is, pure GA man, and I'm sure they had a big night in Downing's last night, fully deserved.
I'd say it'll probably run into weeks, if the truth be told. And Mallon, you feel for them too. There was just a snapshot kick right at the death of that game that looked like it was just going to settle it. They'd have won by a point, so it'll be heartbreak for them. Junior final also at the weekend.
Yeah, indeed. And I suppose the Downing boys can't over-celebrate. They're playing Ballyhays of Cavan and Ulster. That's the next up for them. But yeah, Narasa, Greg, yeah, again, great backstories to this match. Declan Bonner, of course, the legend of Donegal football, took over the team. And as soon as his name was linked with it, you think, right, this is championship time, and he got together a great squad there, and they were shooting the lights out at times in this championship. And Mavell, unbelievable backstory to them, Greg, with Pat McLaughlin, who was soccer manager, and he takes on Johnny Quigg along with him. Johnny, able to play with Johnny at Van Harps, brilliant soccer player, coach, able to play with Derry City and some of them glory years and that. So the two lads take over the team. And Quiggy, there's an interview up on the Highland side there from last week. In his own words, you know, he said to the wife, I'm going down to manage Mavell. And he was like, Mavell Celtic? And he was like, no, I'm a Gaelic. I'm going to manage a Gaelic team. She was like, you know, no, I'm a Gaelic. So anyway, the two boys take over Mavell. And there they are in the final. They were a point up with a minute to go. I just felt for them in the game, you know, you have game management there. They're a front foot attacking type team, and they ended up sitting very deep in the second half. I don't think it suited them. There probably was a moment in the game where the big midfielder, Deverman, threw, there was a goal opportunity on. If they had been a couple of points up, they might have had enough, but there was a wee bit extra, I think, craft and guile with Narasa, particularly with Oisin Caulfield in particular. I thought he was first class.
Now, unfortunately, we've less time this week than we normally do. There was plenty of other action at the weekend, which you'll touch on, of course, and with an eye forward as well, because the big one, Gwydor versus Niamh Connell. You're going to have a great team in situ. You're doing the show live from Highland Motors, is that right?
That's it. We're going across Highland Motors, of course, the great sponsors of all our sporting shows. So we're going to do it in their studio. Cool. With officials up from Gwydor, John Gilday, Gary McDade, and Brendan Kilcoyne's coming along. So it should be a great show. We're going to preview, we'll obviously discuss the games from the weekend, and then look forward to the big one, the Crunch senior final, Greg. So listen, it'll be an exciting time ahead, and I'm looking forward to the show. And everybody tune in if you can, or listen back on HighlandRadio.com.
Just after 7. Thanks so much, Brendan. Really do appreciate it. That's Brendan Devenny. Looking forward to the DL debate. We're joined on the programme now by Mr. Michael Sugru, consultant surgeon at Letterkenny University Hospital. Michael, thank you for your time today. I really do appreciate it greatly.
Thank you very much, Greg. I just would like to say that it's difficult for me to come and talk about this in the open. I find it personally distressing, and I can understand how other people would have difficulty coming forward and speaking about it. So having been here for 16 years and loving the hospital and the patients of the Northwest, this is a difficult moment for me, Greg.
We appreciate it, and I can understand exactly why you might feel like that. But why now then? Why did it? What point have we come to that you and 10 of your colleagues, you know, from within the hospital, have had to issue this public letter, this public statement of great significance?
Well, we've been thinking about this for some time. You know, a lot of thought has gone into this, and discussion, and wondering, can we improve the situation? But the sad thing is, for the patients, we're here to try and improve patient care. The sad thing for the patients of the Northwest currently is that their access to patient care is difficult. The problems are starting in the emergency department, but continue throughout the spectrum of the hospital. The consultants who signed this are very senior consultants. Our soul and heart is in the Donegal region, and we want our patients to get a fair deal. We want them treated in a timely fashion. We accept, Greg, that in the Northwest we can't have certain services because it's not possible. We're not asking for that. But we're just asking for our patients to get reasonable access, a fair go, and to be appropriately funded so that we can actually provide a service that's safe.
Why do you believe the funding just short of €7,000 per patient at Letterkenny University Hospital, even though it's the sixth busiest hospital in the country, what can there be any excuse for that?
No. But we can try and make excuses for it. And we recognise, all the consultants recognise, that it's a difficult time in health service delivery across different hospitals. Every hospital has a difficulty. But the difficulties that we're facing are immense. We're geographically isolated. We don't have access of rail. We don't have motorway access. And it's very difficult for us. We have to have a minimum standard. So the reason the figures are so low for our funding is mind-boggling. We are the sixth busiest hospital in the country on inpatient data. So when people come and work here, they are just find it so challenging because our funding is basically the 14th rated funding. So this is not fair. It's not appropriate. And it's time. And this is why we followed up on the GP letter, because the GPs took a stance. 79 GPs said, this is unacceptable. And now you have 11 senior consultants saying, it's unacceptable. And there needs to be a mindset change to recognize that there is a problem. Until people recognize, and it's called open disclosure, there is a problem, and we're saying, along with our GP colleagues, and reinforcing what they've said, there is a problem. And working with that and realizing that there is a problem, then you can start making solutions. However, you may decide, I'm going to fudge the figures and say, okay, yes, St. James's Hospital is a level four, so therefore their patients are going to get more money. And that's understandable because some of the complexity is greater. But in black and white, it doesn't fit.
Another signatory is Dr. Louise Moran, who's a consultant anaesthetist. I'm sure, good morning to you, Louise. Thank you for your time. You know, we heard from Mr. Sugru, you know, the heartfelt upset, really, of having to have this conversation out in the open. Is that are those emotions that you share with Mr. Sugru?
Yeah, it is really difficult. I think if there was an easy solution, we would have solved the problem already. I think there are numerous people within this hospital that have tried for years to improve the service, talking from individual consultants, departments, the management have to be included in this, have made loads of efforts with loads of projects, but they are constantly failing because of lack of funding, lack of resources, and a significantly inadequate number of beds. The space in the hospital is not enough for the population of Donegal.
Well, just on that point, Louise, and sorry to cut across you, the HSE has released quite a lengthy statement, too lengthy for me to go through while I'm on air, but they recognise that an extra 91 additional beds are needed at LUH by 2030. And then they talk about development control plans and all this type of stuff. When you hear that, does that answer some of your concerns? Do you sort of say, right, okay, well, they get it, 91 beds by 2030. I'm sure they'll be delivered. You know, from your position, when you hear that, what does it say to you?
It says it's a little late. There was not enough beds when I started here 11, 12 years ago. There have been loads of plans to talk about expansion of the hospital, but nothing. I understand a big department like the HSE moves slowly, but it's extremely slowly. But I think we're talking about the difference in funding, and we're talking about Model 4 hospitals having a much higher funding because of complexity and some of the people that are referred here from the rural communities into Dublin. But if you look at Sligo Hospital, they have significantly more funding, and they really are on a per capita. And they're really on a par to us in terms of services.
It's double. It's not far off double the funding.
Yeah. And it's not just the beds. It's as well as it's the services such as neurology. There's no neurologists. There's no ENT service. They come and they visit and they do outpatients. There's no dermatology. There's no rheumatology. The people of Donegal are with no infrastructure, no travel infrastructure, have to travel the furthest out of every single hospital in the country, and it's just consistently poor. So yes, there's beds coming down the line. Yes, there's little projects, but there's been projects all along that are pulled. The urology service had a great rapid assessment unit, but then it had to be removed because we needed more inpatient beds, because it isn't acceptable to leave patients on chairs in the emergency department. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I do feel for the management here, they're stuck. And I actually think that this problem is above their pay grade. We need to be going to the government, to the Ministry of Health, and saying, this is actually a hospital in crisis now, and we need urgent help now and not in 7 or 8 years' time.
So in their response, Mr. Sugru, they say they're working on a range of investment and development projects, an extension to the EDs being progressed, increasing staff at LUH, works underway across the group and LUH to address challenges to the radiology services. There's a significant work taking place to progress discharges and treat patients, and they list that off. Then they talk of this meeting older people at the front door, frailty at the front door, but no one's encountered that, but apparently it's in place at the ED. But Mr. Sugru, when are they just re-announcing stuff that you've heard at meetings and that, or is there anything in this that speaks to you and says, right, they've heard our concerns and now they're maybe perhaps going to do something about it? Because the listeners, if I just read that, they might go, wow, okay, that was quick. Things are going to get better now. So I'd like your assessment of that, Michael, if that's possible.
Yes, well, these are commendable things that they have put forward. But the reality is, on a day-to-day basis, there are patients, some are potentially dying from inability to get timely care. Yeah. Some are losing organs. Some are having adverse outcomes. So this is a crisis that actually has to be addressed in the next 4 to 8 weeks, where there is a plan in action taken with set timelines. So in terms of the services in the hospital, we need to be able to have cardiology consults. We need diabetes. We need to be able to get our patients in for their elective surgery so they're not being presenting as emergencies. So no, yes, it's commendable, but no, it's not going to work. And the management here have made efforts, and they need now to be supported by the Department of Health and the HSE and the minister to say, yes, we recognize this is a rather unique problem and we are going to come and help you. It is totally unacceptable for people not to be able to receive timely treatment. So when we're on call, we're down in the emergency department, climbing over bodies, trying to examine people. I actually offered to examine a patient on the floor on my last on call. I'm on call this week. And it is barbaric. It is inhumane, undignified. And it's not right for the people of the Northwest. And people need to get up and stand up for their right as a human being to get appropriately dignified, timely treatment. Not all treatment will ever be available in our hospital, and we accept that.
Louise, I mean, incredibly strong but well thought out words. It's clear that this is, we're not speaking off the top of our heads here, but you know, it's a real eye opener, Louise. But obviously, something that you're Dr. Louise Moore, and you're very familiar with yourself.
Yeah, and I can give you an example. A lot of the improvements that you've talked about are welcome. We have heard about them, but they're a long time coming. And I'll give you an example within my area. Obviously, we are the doctors that are running the intensive care unit. The intensive care unit is a 5-bedded unit that was built when the catchment area for the hospital in the 80s was 50,000 people. It's now 160,000. There was an inquiry and a coroner's inquest into an there was a coroner's inquest back in 2016, 2017, and a report that Letterkenny needed a 15-bedded critical care unit to cover a high dependency unit and an ICU. And that was from an incident that happened in 2013. And here we are in 2023, and we have a 5-bedded intensive care unit, and we got funded for one extra nurse, but there's nowhere physically to put that patient. So we have a small room off the surgical ward, which counts as our 6th bed for intensive care, but it's geographically distant and not a safe place to be in terms of intensive care nursing. And there is a interim plan to put a 10-bedded critical care unit, which has stalled because it needs HSE funding above the level that Sean Murphy is allowed to approve of a few hundred thousand, and the HSE estates haven't replied. And here we are going into another winter with a 5-bedded intensive care unit for a population that really needs a 15-bedded critical care unit that was highlighted in 2017 or 18. I might have the dates slightly wrong, but highlighted a number of years ago that has not progressed. And that is not from Sean Murphy not wanting to try. That is not from us, you know, pleading with SAILTA. But even this is above SAILTA, this is HSE estates, and they are thinking about it. We haven't got the funding approved yet still. And there are people on the wards, if they're lucky enough to get out of ED, who are deteriorating and can't be taken to a safe place to have the best care because it's not physically there.
Okay, we're in a relatively mild October, but we saw in August a situation, Dr. Moran, whereby there were no ambulances available because the patients couldn't be gotten off them and get them away. So we're not even in winter yet. How worried are you for winter? We heard Mr. Sugru talking about something needed done within the next 4 to 8 weeks, but if this falls on deaf ears, how concerned are you for the winter that lies ahead?
I am worried every winter. People are stretched, and it is affecting the morale in the hospital, and the nurses work so hard. And I think you'll find every patient that comes in is not critical of the nurses or the doctors. They are working their best in a very difficult environment. It's very hard for an emergency department to run when they only have one cubicle space left, and then they have the corridors lined with patients sitting in chairs. And I think, you know, I'm a slightly remote service because we only get called for the very sick patients in the emergency department, or maybe to go and help put a line in. But I have to walk past people to the resuscitation area, and And I feel terrible walking past them to go to a very sick patient. And they're sitting lined up in chairs, elderly patients in their 70s and 80s on drips for over 24 hours in a row. And it's heartbreaking to see. And there's nothing that I can do. And it's unfortunately only going to get worse.
What's your morale like, Louise?
Say that again.
What's your morale like? I'm sure you could ply your trade in many different places, probably with a greater climate, more money. What's your morale like at the moment?
I married a man from Fannad, so I'm stuck here.
Right, you're stuck. Next question. No, we're pleased.
We have a really lovely department, and we work with a lovely bunch of nurses in intensive care and theatres. And I think, and we have a very active anaesthetic department. We have a lot of senior trainees that come from the rest of the country here, more so than the rest of the hospital. So with the morale within our department, we are relatively shielded from the atrocities of the emergency department. So I think the physicians are really, really struggling. They are working so hard and so many hours, and their difficulty filling their posts. And I really want to give them a hand, but I don't know how to. Mm-hmm. But without the resources, it's very, very hard. And there's one more thing. The HSE has the hospital groups, and within each hospital group, every hospital is meant to have a clinical director for each service, one for medicine, one for perioperative. But within SAILTA, they decided that they'd have a clinical director in Galway and associate clinical directors here. So the clinicians here are not given the time. They're given 4 hours a week, whereas in Galway and every other hospital in the country, they're given 2 full days a week to try and solve these problems. So they're very much firefighting rather than being able to proactively go out and do things. But that was SAILTA's model of management care, is just to have sort of this reduced, non-recommended.
So finally, I know both you're on call and incredibly busy. Michael Sugru, Mr. Michael Sugru. So in ways that we can understand, because what you issued was, you know, it's a medical document almost in terms of what's required. And so what has to happen as immediately, midterm, medium term?
There has to be a recognition and a statement from the Department of Health and the HSC that the current level of support for this hospital and the plan is not adequate. They have to listen to the GPs and the consultants who are saying enough is enough for our patients. Our patients deserve better. We don't want them dying in the emergency department. We don't want them dying in a recovery room waiting for an ICU bed. There has to be a plan to encompass across medicine, surgery, endocrine, urology, cardiology. And particularly, if we order an X-ray, we should be able to get an X-ray. We need more radiologists. And it's not about morale of the staff. It's about patient care. If you can provide good patient care, you have a great morale. What we're finding is, because of the difficulties in providing basic clinical care, Greg, people don't want to work here. And this is the challenge. It's a challenge in recruitment and retention right across consultant, nursing, allied health. And this has to stop.
I want to be really clear and really fair on this programme in terms of where responsibility lies, not only in just my questions, but in sort of, you know, reading out responses. I mean, I presume you guys in management locally are on the same page. Like, if it were within, you know, we can't speak on his behalf, but the hospital general manager to sign this, perhaps maybe he would have signed it. Can any of you talk to that? Is this an external problem? As I say, I just want to make sure that the tone of this is correct going forward.
It is very difficult, Greg, to sign a letter like I've just signed, along with 10 or 11 colleagues. It is one of the most difficult things I've had to do in my 30 years as a consultant, to say there's a problem where I work. Everyone has had difficulty signing this letter. I know there are consequences, and we fear the consequences of this. The management must be supported externally. They're not empowered. Our local management are not empowered to solve this problem, nor does it appear that the SAILTA group are. It has to come from the Department of Health, the HSE, and the minister to say enough is enough.
And Dr. Louise, you don't face sanction for this, do you? Or could you?
No, I don't think we do face sanction, but I think whilst the management are fully aware of the problems and they're working towards them, I think they would rather they had been kept internal I think they are concerned that it would only add to the recruitment problem for Donegal if they feel that a bunch of consultants are standing up and saying, hang on a second, our hospital's not great. But actually, I think it shows great collegiality that we have come together and say, we want better for our patients. We want our patients to have a better outcome, mm-hmm. to have a better experience in the hospital. And that might not be popular with management for me to be sitting here and saying that, but do I feel I can sanction? Hopefully not. Okay. But no, I don't think they will sanction
me. That's good. Dr. Louise Moran, thank you so much for your time and thanks for the great work that you do. Also, the same to you. Mr. Michael Sugru, we do appreciate it and we recognise how difficult this is for you, and hopefully it's a means to an end though and something positive comes from it. But for now, thank you so very much indeed.
And thank you for highlighting it and bringing it to the attention of the nation.
No problem. Thank you very much indeed. That's what we try and do here on the 9 till noon show. Now, there's a new book just published on the 12th of October. John Hume, The Persuader. Its author is Stephen Walker and he joins us on the programme now. Stephen, thank you so very much for your time today.
Nice to talk to you.
Good to have you with us. A lot of work went into this, and I suppose it had to be, given the subject of the book. It had to get all of your all of the skills that you've acquired over your career into this.
Well, he's a big figure. He was a big figure in Irish history, a big figure in world history, and he led many lives. And I started to think about writing this book when John Hume died back in 2020. Obviously, as a journalist with the BBC over 30-odd years, I interviewed him in many places, in London, in Belfast, in Derry. I was well aware of his political career. But it was only when he died that I began to realise that there were many layers to John Hume. There was John Hume, the young man who was possibly going to be a priest. There was John Hume, the teacher. There was John Hume, the civil rights activist. There was even John Hume, the fish salesman, which I didn't know an awful lot about because he set up a smoked salmon cooperative in Derry. So there was a lot to look at, and I spent quite some time talking to friends and family, and particularly his family, and without the help and support of his family, this would be a much lesser book. And they have been very kind and patient to me, although I have to stress it is not an authorised biography. So you're absolutely right. There was an awful lot to look at.
Yeah, and indeed, and 100, over 100 odd interviews, many of them with John Hume himself, and some that had heretofore gone unpublished. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, what's quite interesting about that is that the publishers who have published this are Gill Books down in Dublin, and they had tried to do a memoir with John Hume 20 years ago, back in 2002, 2003, and they commissioned a series of interviews. So when I was talking to the publishers about the possibility of publishing this book, they told me that they had these 25 unpublished interviews. Oh, wow. And that if we worked together, then we could put those in the book. And that's exactly what they've done. He sat down with a local journalist called Frank Darcy and over a period of time did a series of interviews. He was interviewed. John Hume's wife, Pat, was interviewed. And Pat Hume is a central figure in the story of John Hume, and she's a central figure in the book as well. And there was also an interview with John's brother, Patsy. So that's really nice that I'm able to bring new material to the table that we haven't seen before.
Some of those you interviewed would have been critics of John Hume. How did you strike that balance there to sort of tell the whole story from different perspectives, but at the same time for it not to come across that you maybe went too far in trying to strike that, if that makes sense?
Well, I suppose I used my BBC training and that I tried to encompass all views as best I could. You know, I hope the book is balanced. I hope the book is fair, you know, and the family are not expecting a hagiography. And I've made it very, very clear that this is not a hagiography. This is neither is it, to use a tabloid term, a hatchet job. So I spoke to people within the party who were even critical of his party leadership. And there are people in the book that think John Hume was a brilliant political leader and a brilliant political strategist, but they have criticisms of the way that he ran the party. Likewise, there are others in other political parties who feel he should have done things differently. So there are people from the unionist community who have concerns about the way that John Hume said certain things. And so I'd like to think what I'm trying to present is a rounded figure. And John Hume was a complex man. We are all complex. Mm-hmm. None of us are perfect. We all have many faults and idiosyncrasies. And I hope I've been able to get across some of John Hume's particular idiosyncrasies.
I mean, you've been covering politics for 30 plus years across Northern Ireland and would have been very familiar with John Hume. Obviously, you learned about perhaps him selling fish. That was something new. But outside of that, maybe more on a personal level, is there anything about Mr. Hume that you learned through this process that you're surprised you weren't aware of over the previous 30 years?
Well, I think what struck me particularly was the level of networking that he did. Mm. His level of networking, which I was aware of, but I wasn't aware of to the extent of it. And over the years, he built up the most amazing network of contacts in Belfast, in Derry, in London, in Washington, and of course in Europe. And very early on, he realized that if there was to be a solution to the troubles of Northern Ireland, it could not be solved in Northern Ireland alone. The people of Northern Ireland needed help, and the politicians of Northern Ireland needed help. And you couldn't look at Northern Ireland in isolation. Mm-hmm. And I think once you start to study the way that John Hume handled himself politically, you get a great sense of the networking that he did. And that led to him having enormous influence. He reached a point in the peace process, particularly when the Americans were involved. And obviously the UK government would look at the Americans, and the Americans would often say, let's just pause. What does John Hume think? Mm. And to get that level of interest in the White House, in the office of the most powerful man in the world, gives you an indication of the kind of influence that John Hume had.
Fascinating stuff. Now, most people would know the parts of John Hume's life, but then obviously in the latter years, in the final years of his life, we weren't as exposed to as much as we had been in the past. You give us a bit of an insight into those final years, a glimpse, I think it's described as, into the final years of his life.
Yes, obviously he had dementia. And he wasn't able to remember some of the key things he was involved in, the Hume Adams, the Good Friday Agreement, the peace process. And he didn't really get the retirement that he probably should have deserved. What's interesting about the latter years of John Hume is that he was surrounded by a blanket of love. He was surrounded by a blanket of love by the people of Derry, because he used to go walking the streets of Derry, and Pat Hume didn't really worry about him because she knew that somebody would offer him a lift home. Yes. Somebody would say, oh, there's John Hume, and they'd wind down the window and say, John, do you want a lift home? And they'd take him home. Yeah. Or if he was out having a cup of tea or a drink, someone would make sure he got home. So Pat Hume is on record as saying she found Derry to be a very dementia-friendly city. So she was very... And I thought that was quite nice in the way that here was a city, in a sense, saying thank you to a man who had looked after them and represented them and fought for them. And then in his final years, when he needed a bit of help and support, the favour was being returned. And I thought that was quite nice. And there's and then in his later years, obviously, he was in a home very close to the border, and he was looked after very lovingly and caringly by the staff there. And the family were very pleased about the level of care he got. And one of his carers is Amy McCluskey. She is in the book. She talks for the first time about the love and care that John was given in the home. And the fact that even though large parts of his memory had gone, he was still able to sing. Mm. He was still able to sing in English, in Irish, and in French. So he was still able to perform. And there are some nice moments towards the end of John Hume's life. And Amy McCluskey speaks about that in the book.
Yeah, and I'm sure you really felt, and you've sort of talked on it a little earlier, the desire, maybe even pressure, to get this right. And you're happy with that, obviously, I think. And it's been received in a way that would tell you that you've got this right.
Well, people will always criticise, you know, we're flawed and sorry?
I'd say stay off Twitter, you'll be okay.
So, you know, people will always have an opinion. People may dispute, oh, I think your interpretation is slightly wrong there or whatever. But I mean, I've tried to use as many sources as I can. I've spoken to family, I've spoken to friends, I've spoken to colleagues, I've spoken to political rivals. And I've had to do an awful lot of transcripts because, as you know very well, 100 interviews means 100 transcripts. I'm afraid that's a lot of trees. I'm sorry about that, but nonetheless. So there's a lot of people. So I've tried to make sure that where I'm using sources, that they are properly sourced, that I'm based on what people exactly told me.
Yeah.
But there are always going to be people that may question certain things.
Of course. And it's beautifully put together and very accessible the way it's been laid out too, for people to read and enjoy. Stephen, it's available presumably from all the usual places?
It is. It's available, as they say, the cliche, all good bookshops. It's available on the internet as well. But I'd love it if you went to your local bookstore. That Indeed. Would be brilliant. But it certainly is available.
There'll be a lot available. Of interest, obviously, because John Hume was a regular at the likes of the McGill Summer School. He had a property in Mobile. And so there'll be a lot of interest here right across the Northwest in Donegal.
He was a big fan of Donegal. And Donegal is a very important part of the John Hume story.
Yeah, okay. Read all about it in John Hume, The Persuader. Stephen Walker, thank you so very much and congratulations on a great piece of work. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care of yourself. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts. Lucia Ramsey is a teacher at ATU. A teacher with Maths Learning Centre and joins us on the programme now. Lucia, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Greg. How are you?
I am good. Maths Week started on Saturday, October 14th, continues until the 22nd of October. It's a celebration of maths. Maths is exciting if you're interested in it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Very exciting and inspiring. And this is maybe the point of Maths Week, is try to change people's attitude towards mathematics so they get to like it and have more success with it. Also to make it available to all people of all backgrounds, all ages and all abilities.
I presume people sort of go, well, why didn't I've learnt that at school and I've never used it? It's a waste of time. But presumably when with maths, it's not just about maths itself. It helps us learn other things and retain other information, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's quite like maybe the language of the universe, but maybe that's a bit much. But it is, it's got a lot of practical uses. It's used in almost everything you come across, every trade that you do. Most professions will also use mathematics, and all the STEM subjects are all underlined by mathematics.
So what's coming up over the next week or up until the 22nd, and how can people get involved?
Okay, well, what we're doing at the Maths Learning Centre with the ATU is we're holding a series of maths workshops tomorrow, Tuesday the 17th of October. We are presenting a Colm Mulcahy. He is an Irish mathematician, and he will be doing the workshops. He is Professor Emeritus of Spelman College, Atlanta, USA, and he's a recognized expert in recreational maths. So he will bring maths to life in a very fun and exciting way. He's he's an academic columnist, a book author, a blogger, and he has puzzles in the New York Times. But his main interests at the minute are mathematical card magic, algebra, number theory, and geometry. And he's worked with Maths Week for several years now.
Brilliant.
So we are delighted that he's coming.
And is the space still available, Lucia? Or how could people sign up if there are?
Unfortunately, with us, the space is fully booked.
Oh, well,
and it has been for a while. Yeah, we really need to build the capacity to take on more students, especially national students.
Mm.
You know, we have four sessions going. The two with the national schools are totally booked up. The secondary school session is totally booked up. And then the only session that has availability, and that's because we just decided to try it on Friday, is we're doing a surprise 1 hour for ATU students from 10:30 to 11:30 in Lecture Theatre 1102. And that's it. But next
what
year,
day is
hopefully,
that, Lucia?
Tomorrow.
Okay,
tomorrow.
Brilliant. Fantastic stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a huge response. Like almost 9,700 pupils have signed up. In Donegal alone, that's just in this county.
Yeah, it's massive. This has been growing.
Yeah.
It's like the third highest, next to the Young Scientist of the Year and Ireland Science Week. This is the next biggest thing.
Brilliant. Okay, and the Maths Learning Centre, are you on the web? On the web, if people want to check out what's going on there.
Yeah, well, probably you'd be better off getting it through mathsweek.ie.
Okay.
They have Maths Week news. You know, TV, events, schedules, resources, information, activities, everything.
Brilliant. Okay, Lucia, thank you so much for that. Enjoy the rest of the maths week.
Okay, and thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. That's Lucia Ramsey there, teacher with Maths Learning Centre. We're towards the end of the programme here, but let's read some of your comments, and we've had hundreds, so every time, as I just literally read the first word of one every time, so if we don't get to all of them today, of course, which we couldn't, we'll carry them over to tomorrow. There are people that the government should be listening to. The government have failed us for years and now it's falling apart. Could we not be looking to use the old St. Connell's campus in some capacity? Money is going to be wasted looking about a rail service in Donegal, which will never happen anyway. Millions has already been wasted on the four-lane project, which in reality is two new footpaths, two cycle lanes and a couple sets of lights. That's more to it than that, but I take your point. Every time I hear about the healthcare in Donegal, I'm outraged. We're sending buses to Galway. It's just so shocking that this is actually happening. Hi, Greg. Thank you and sincere thanks to those wonderful consultants. What do we as a people, where in God's name are our politicians in all of this? Do we protest on foot? Dear God, we did it for water a few years back. We need to support the doctors and consultants who are speaking up now. What can we do? Well, hold your fire, because the GPs have said that if action is not seen to be taking place, that they will lead protests and they will be part of protests, and you will be able to vent your frustrations with your feet. I don't think it should be underestimated to have two top consultants at Letterkenny University Hospital coming out, and particularly with Mr. Sugru, some of the language he used to describe conditions at the hospital. It's it doesn't happen very often, and it happened today here in the 9 till noon show. I commend these doctors, consultants for speaking up. It's becoming impossible and incredibly challenging to their morale. Who wants to work in a place where it's becoming impossible to do your work? Patient care is paramount. And we, the people of the Northwest, now need to get behind these doctors and nurses. What's really going on with the crisis at the hospital, asks a caller. We just hear we are the forgotten county, etc., in terms of funding, but this excuse doesn't add up. It's a strategic plan by the government, they ask. The funding's available, but for some reason they just ain't giving it to Donegal Hospital to sort out the mess. It really is unbelievable. The state of healthcare in Letterkenny University Hospital is like a third world country. Well, that's a big thrust of the conversation we've been having. We've been highlighting on numerous occasions today and before the funding gap. And it was interesting from Louise, Dr. Louise there. Sligo is very, very similar to Letterkenny University Hospital, but they get double the money per patient. Why is that? And how can that be acceptable? We'll continue with this topic and more, of course, when we return with the 9 till noon show tomorrow morning from 9. From me, Greg Hughes and Donna Marie Doherty, researched and produced. Have a lovely Monday.